Chapter 38. Saddest of the Falls. The last thing Grant needed after the whiskey ring scandal was more cabinet wrongdoing, but the bloodletting had not yet ceased. The tenure of Secretary of the Interior, Columbus Delano, had been shadowed by controversy. His department was rife with fraud, suffering from accusations of an Indian ring of corrupt agents who exploited Native Americans. To worsen matters, his son was accused of blackmail and corruption in the Wyoming Territory. As charges against Delano mounted, Grant resisted pleas to sack him. "If Delano were now to resign," he told Fish, "it would be retreating under fire and be accepted as an admission of the charges." Bristow was especially upset that Grant failed to clean house and force Delano's resignation. Before long, congressional scrutiny turned to Orville Grant, who had received 4 profitable Indian trading posts at a time when such trading licenses were virtual presses to print money. The New York Times conjectured that for 2 years, not a single important tradership had been secured without the payment of large sums. In July 1875, press speculation suggested that Delano was privy to misdeeds involving Orville. One newspaper presumed to know that at a heated Long Branch session between Grant and Delano, the Interior Secretary had made threats of exposure concerning privileges granted Orville Grant, a brother of the president, if his own resignation was enforced, but gave assurances that if not molested until after the Indian frauds investigation had been concluded, he would quietly step down and out. The scandal around Indian trading posts edged closer to Grant in February 1876, when the New York Herald charged Orville with taking kickbacks from a sutler. "Let the president send for his own brother," the paper intoned, "and question him about the money that was made in the Sioux country by starving the squaws and children." Summoned by a House committee delving into War Department expenditures, Orville testified that he had told his brother of his desire to secure Indian trading posts in 1874 and had gotten one at Fort Peck and a second at Standing Rock. "I suppose I feel grateful to my brother and indebted to him for getting that post at Standing Rock." The interrogator pressed him. "You consider, then, that you do have influence with the president to manage these matters to some extent?" "To some extent I have," replied Orville breezily, "though I am sorry to say they are of very little profit to me." In fact, Grant had told Orville about 4 trading posts that would soon be vacated. Orville had applied for and received all 4, installing partners who shared half the proceeds with him without a shred of work on Orville's part. Orville's testimony vastly embarrassed his brother, though he admitted that the president was ignorant that he had skimmed money from these transactions. A cheerfully amoral man, Orville betrayed not one scintilla of remorse about his misdeeds. What nobody knew, except possibly his brother, was that Orville was slipping into madness. Its main symptom would be a manic appetite for speculation that veered off into extravagant fantasies about cornering markets and gobbling up businesses. That Orville was such an affable witness, seemingly unaware of the harm he caused his brother, suggests the madness had already taken root. The press had a field day with his rambling ruminations. The Nation commented that he told his own story of his jobs as an Indian trader in a simple, artless way that would be diverting if it were not for the picture it presents of the views entertained by the presidential family on the science of politics. Nor was the president spared journalistic venom. "Under an honest and high-toned civil service," the New York Tribune lectured, "the president would consider it his first duty to see that traders at Indian posts are responsible men, and that their trade is regulated for the best interests of the Indians." In fact, starting with Eli Parker and the Quakers, Grant had worked long and hard to ban corruption on the reservations. The last cabinet secretary enveloped by scandal was Secretary of War William W. Belknap. who had shown little sympathy for Reconstruction or Grant's peace policy toward the Indians. From his earliest days as War Secretary, Belknap had entertained sumptuously at his Lafayette Square home with his second wife, Carrie, a beautiful Kentucky belle who captivated guests. When Mrs. Belknap exhibited a conspicuous taste for luxury, it seemed mysterious to Washington observers how she managed it. It turned out she had helped businessman Caleb P. Marsh to obtain a trading post at Fort Sill in Indian Territory that was currently held by a John S. Evans. To keep his lucrative position, Evans agreed to make quarterly payments to Marsh and Mrs. Belknap, who split a $12,000 annual kickback. When Carrie Belknap died of tuberculosis in December 1870, her husband went on pocketing the extorted money, feigning ignorance of its source. In December 1873, he married his sister-in-law, Amanda, nicknamed Puss, and famous for her gowns and costly jewels. The War Secretary still banked the illegal payments made to the previous Mrs. Belknap, albeit now at a reduced rate. In time, the new Mrs. Belknap became a recipient of this flow of largesse. In all, the Belknap household received $20,000 from Evans, the equivalent of 2.5 years' salary for the War Secretary, another example of Gilded Age gluttony in Washington. In early March 1876, a House committee, headed by Heister Clymer of Pennsylvania, pieced together evidence that Belknap had taken hefty payments for an Indian trading post and prepared to release a report recommending his impeachment. A Democrat and a confirmed racist, one of his campaign posters proclaimed, "Clymer's platform is for the white man." He was eager to discredit Reconstruction, and savaging the War Secretary was a handy way to do so. Not masking his hatred for Grant, Clymer declaimed against the corruption, the extravagance, the misgovernment which has cursed this land for years past. At 10 a.m. on March 2nd, Belknap, knowing the Congressional Committee would present its critical report that afternoon, rushed to the White House in an unholy panic to tender his resignation. Rumors even made the rounds on Capitol Hill that Belknap had shot himself. At breakfast, Bristow had tipped off Grant that Congress had gathered incriminating evidence on Belknap, which came as a complete surprise to him. He was distracted by the Orville Babcock case and blindsided by the sudden appearance of this news scandal. According to Julia Grant, he was heading out to have his portrait painted when a White House steward informed him that Belknap and Secretary of the Interior Zachariah Chandler wished to see him in the Red Room. "I cannot now," Grant said, "but will when I return." "Oh, Mr. President, do see Mr. Belknap before you go," the steward urged. "He is in some trouble and looks very ill." In the Red Room, a wildly discomposed Belknap, Julia described him as hoarse and deadly pale, offered to resign. "Accept it at once," Belknap cried. "Do not hesitate, Mr. President. For God's sake, do not hesitate." "Certainly," Grant conceded, slightly mystified. "If you wish it." Belknap fostered the impression that he was acting gallantly to save his wife, not his own scalp. Years later, Jesse Grant said his father suggested the resignation to Belknap, and that the two of them always thought Belknap an upright, chivalrous man, worthy of all respect. In a curt letter, Grant accepted Belknap's resignation. "Your tender of resignation as Secretary of War, with the request that it be accepted immediately, is received, and the same is hereby accepted with great regret." "Thank you. You are always kind," said Belknap, beating a hasty retreat from the room. His unseemly haste should have alerted Grant that something was amiss. The president had acted impetuously, unaware of the full legal ramifications of his action. In typically unflappable style, Grant strode off to the studio of Prussian-born artist Henry Ulke, oblivious to the tremendous hubbub now shaking Capitol Hill. When impeachment articles against Belknap passed that afternoon, Grant's premature acceptance of his resignation threatened to sabotage the process, having made Belknap a private citizen at the time he was impeached. This fresh scandal renewed questions about Grant's judgment. As the Washington correspondent for the notoriously anti-administration New York Herald sketched events that day in Congress, "When the letter of the president was read, stating that he had accepted the secretary's resignation at 10:30, there was a murmur of amazement at what looked to everybody then like an act deliberately intended to shield Mr. Belknap. But when the terms of the letter were read, in which the president tells Mr. Belknap that he accepts his resignation with great regret, people turned to each other with indignation at something which seemed to them an open defiance of decency and of public opinion. The discussion turned mainly on the question of the power of the House to impeach a person who had resigned office." The next day, in a confessional mode, Grant informed his cabinet that when Belknap first arrived, he hadn't fathomed the scandal's magnitude. Belknap had been so overcome with emotion, he said, that he could hardly spill out his words. Only later in the day, when Grant learned that Belknap hoped to escape impeachment, did he recognize the gravity of what he had done. As so often with Grant, he saw the Belknap case in personal rather than political terms. He spoke of his long-continued acquaintance with Belknap in the Army, Fish wrote, of his having known his father as one of the finest officers of the old Army when he himself was a young lieutenant. Profoundly shaken, Grant instructed Attorney General Pierrepont to pursue Belknap in criminal or civil court. John Eaton recalled that the episode had a very disturbing effect upon the president. "I remember his asking me in connection with it if I had any knowledge or suspicion of corruption in any of the other departments." Although the cabinet recommended Rutherford B. Hayes as Belknap's successor, Grant turned instead to Senator Lott M. Morrill of Maine. In an ominous sign for the lame duck president, Morrill refused, confiding to Fish that he was deterred by Orville Babcock and other unsavory White House characters. Grant gave the job to Yale-educated Alfonso Taft of Cincinnati, an influential judge and father of William Howard, the future president. Even in a capital inured to scandal, Belknap's downfall produced deep reverberations. "The corruptions of this administration seem to permeate every department of the government," wrote Orville Hickman Browning, a sturdy Grant hater, with grim satisfaction. More sympathetically, Amos Ackerman declared that he had thought Belknap to be thoroughly upright. "This is to me the saddest of the falls of our public men." While William Tecumseh Sherman had long grumbled that Belknap bypassed him in military matters, he had never suspected malfeasance. "I feel sorry for Belknap. I don't think him naturally dishonest, but how could he live on $8,000 a year in the style that you all beheld?" he wondered aloud to his brother. Amazingly, Grant soon reverted to his childlike belief in Belknap's innocence. By March 7th, a U.S. attorney had issued the first subpoenas for witnesses to appear before a grand jury. When this subject arose at a cabinet meeting, Grant suddenly expressed his faith that Belknap was not guilty. "The cabinet was so taken aback," wrote Fish, "that no response of assent was made by anyone present." Julia Grant had exercised restraint as First Lady, saving political judgments for private talks with her husband, but her friend Amanda Puss Belknap had been ostracized since the scandal, and Julia, like her husband, tended to side with the victim. On March 21st, she personally summoned cabinet members to an extraordinary meeting, imploring them and their wives to visit poor Mrs. Belknap. She says that Mrs. Belknap was very much distressed and had expressed a wish to see her, and that she would come so as not to be either seen or recognized, Fish recorded. Mrs. Grant had refused to let her come in secret, but had seen her when she called on Sunday last during the day. The soul of honesty, Fish told Julia, he hadn't called on the Belknaps because I thought it better for both the Belknaps and the administration that I should not. Secretary of the Navy Robeson hinted at political embarrassments and legal complications that might emerge from such contacts. Reluctantly, Julia agreed to stop seeing Mrs. Belknap. Fish observed that Mrs. Grant was overcome, and in tears said she supposed this was right, but she felt so sorry for them. From a human standpoint, it was a poignant display of empathy, but a shocking case of political naivete. In their psychological makeup, both Ulysses and Julia Grant too readily identified with troubled souls, leaving them exposed to manipulation. On March 31st, Pierrepont broached to the cabinet the prospect of a criminal prosecution of Belknap. Not hedging his words, Fish said candidly that the administration owed it to itself and to the country to press the indictment. Other cabinet secretaries concurred. Whatever his reservations, Grant gave Pierrepont full permission to proceed with a criminal indictment of Belknap. In the end, the evidence didn't justify criminal proceedings. By April, the Senate began to sit as an impeachment court under the tutelage of Chief Justice Waite, and the case dragged on through July. In making his closing statement, Belknap's counsel, Jeremiah S. Black, drew a false analogy between Belknap's accepting gifts and Grant's accepting houses from admirers after the war. His speech showed how poorly Grant's loyalty to Belknap had been repaid. That the present chief magistrate has taken large gifts from his friends is a fact as well known as any other in the history of the country. He did it openly, without an attempt at concealment or denial. He not only received money and lands and houses and goods amounting in the aggregate to an enormous sum, but he conformed the policy of his administration to the interests and wishes of the donors. Nay, he did more than that. He appointed the men who brought him these gifts to the highest offices which he could bestow in return. Does anybody assert that General Grant was guilty of an impeachable crime in taking these presents, even though the receipt of them was followed by official favors extended to the givers? Of course, Grant received gifts for wartime sacrifice, whereas Belknap had taken money from men profiting from his protection. On August 1st, he was acquitted on all 5 impeachment articles, but it was something less than a total vindication. Many senators believed him guilty and only refused to convict him because he had resigned hours before being impeached, returning him to the status of a private citizen. Grant's blunder in accepting his resignation had saved him. A perfect torrent of scandal had swept over the administration, and Grant seemed powerless to stem the rushing, foaming tide. In the face of such overwhelming facts, a few points are worth emphasizing. Grant had not been personally involved in any scandal. His failure had been one of poor selection of cabinet officers and how he handled their downfalls. He never stopped prosecutions of guilty parties and was often insistent about having them prosecuted. It is also important to emphasize that the manufactured outrage over the scandals came from legislators eager to discredit Reconstruction and the moral underpinnings of the administration. Finally, the Grant scandals, which have so clouded his historical reputation, were largely confined to the second half of his second term, obscuring his earlier signal successes as president. Still, endings have a disproportionate influence on any narrative, and this holds true for presidencies as well. Grant's maladroit response to scandal reflected the lack of sophistication in a man who had been a stranger to politics before the war. He could recognize evil in his enemies, but not in those who posed as his friends. Many Americans understood this, and through the many vicissitudes of his administration, retained respect and affection for Grant. Grant shuffled his cabinet one last time in spring 1876. Attorney General Pierrepont was shipped off to London as minister to England, replaced by Alfonso Taft, who had served fleetingly as Secretary of War. Replacing Taft at war was James D. Cameron of Pennsylvania, a Princeton graduate with a background in banking and railway businesses. A man of substantial wealth, Cameron, 43, was little known in political circles except as the son of Senator Simon Cameron, the disgraced war secretary under Abraham Lincoln. Despite his earlier reluctance to replace Belknap, Senator Lott M. Morrill agreed to follow Benjamin Bristow at Treasury. He was an apt choice, having agreed with Grant on financial matters, such as opposing the inflation bill, and had also firmly supported Reconstruction. The final cabinet shakeup came in July, when Marshall Jewell was unexpectedly asked to resign as Postmaster General, an abrupt decision that prompted intense speculation about Grant's motives. "The true reason for the president's action is that Governor Jewell made too many apologies for the administration and was not disposed to stand before all the world as a member of it," the New York Times conjectured. Something about Jewell grated on Grant, who told Fish he could stand his annoyance no longer. In appointing his successor, Grant displayed the mischievous side of his nature. He called in James N. Tyner, Second Assistant Postmaster General, and announced, "I have decided, Mr. Tyner, to ask for your resignation." Tyner blushed, his head drooping. "And to appoint you Postmaster General," Grant added, to Tyner's sudden brightening delight. Thus ended the topsy-turvy history of Grant's many cabinet appointments. Although Grant had rejected a third term and refrained from involvement in choosing a successor, he was hardly indifferent to the fate of a party he had piloted for nearly 8 years. Hamilton Fish had been his most intimate confidant, showing cool, superlative judgment and forming the perfect counterweight to Grant's sometimes unaccountable moods. Grant deemed him the foremost statesman of the age and favored him as his successor. Without telling Fish, Grant secretly drafted a letter of support to be disclosed at the Republican convention if the favorite son candidacies of James Blaine, Oliver Morton, and Roscoe Conkling misfired. While Grant would have happily embraced any of these party regulars, he was still infatuated with Conkling, holding his great character and genius in profound respect, and believing he had been fiercely loyal. Conkling chafed at Grant's refusal to endorse him openly and maintain surface neutrality in the race. The one man Grant didn't care to see nominated was Bristow, who had become a darling of liberal Republicans. In the minds of reformers, Grant remained associated with party bosses who would get their just comeuppance with civil service reform. In mid-April, Carl Schurz rallied Republicans concerned by widespread corruption in our public service, and they met in New York a month later. These insurgents didn't endorse Bristow openly, but agreed to work quietly for him at the Republican convention. For Grant, Bristow was the treacherous cabinet secretary who had connived to discredit him, and he wasn't a man to forget such a supposed betrayal. As Louise Taft, wife of the new attorney general, confided to a friend, "The president's family naturally consider Bristow in league with his enemies, as Bristow's friends all abuse the administration." Party stalwarts agreed with the administration on Reconstruction and were prepared to turn the upcoming election into another contest of loyal Republicans versus disloyal Democrats. They would inveigh against the Klan and make emotional appeals that reminded voters of Northern sacrifice and Southern betrayal during the war. Yet a segment of the Republican Party establishment now wondered aloud whether troops should be withdrawn from the South, leading many blacks to yearn for a third Grant term. As Robert T. Kent of Atlanta wrote to him, "We the colored men and women, boys and girls, yes, even the little children, thank you, dear sir," and he ended with a plea for Grant to stand for re-election. When the Republican convention met in Cincinnati in June, it was feared Bristow's nomination would alienate stalwarts, while Blaine, Morton, and Conkling would deter the party's liberal reformers. The platform implicitly criticized Grant, railing against a corrupt centralism which, after inflicting upon 10 states the rapacity of carpetbag tyranny, has honeycombed the offices of the federal government itself with incapacity, waste, and fraud. The one man who seemed able to unify the party was Governor Rutherford B. Hayes of Ohio, who defeated Blaine for the nomination on the 7th ballot by a 384-351 vote. Congressman William A. Wheeler of New York joined him as the vice presidential candidate. Hayes had been wounded during the war and fought with sufficient gallantry to attain a rank of brevet major general. Grant, having known Hayes well as a congressman and admired him as an honest, sincere man and patriot, hurried off a telegram of hearty support. "I congratulate you and feel the greatest assurance that you will occupy my present position from the 4th of March next." Serenaded by the Marine Band, Grant appeared on the White House balcony to address the party faithful crowded below. "I cannot withhold my approval of the excellent ticket given you by the National Republican Convention at Cincinnati, a ticket that should receive the cordial support of all races in all sections." On July 4th, he invited Hayes to stay at Long Branch and sample the genial sea breeze, fine roads, and beautiful surrounding villages, and pleasant and hospitable neighbors. Perhaps distancing himself from the administration, Hayes studiously avoided such a visit. Grant soon discovered Hayes wasn't the friendly compromise candidate he had envisioned. As early as March 1875, Hayes had admitted privately he was opposed to the course of General Grant on the third term, the civil service, and the appointment of unfit men on partisan or personal grounds. Now, in a letter accepting the nomination, Hayes embraced civil service reform, flayed the spoils system, and promised in advance to spurn a second term. Grant interpreted this last pledge as a backhanded swipe at him. Despite promises to protect Southern blacks, Hayes resorted to code language to suggest a repeal of Reconstruction, telling Southerners he would cherish their truest interests and assist them in obtaining the blessings of honest and capable local government. The New York Tribune reported that Grant thought Hayes's letter in extremely bad taste, and that it reflected upon the present administration. The president's entire manner indicated complete dissatisfaction with the political situation and much personal anger. This coincided with reports portraying Grant as moody and temperamental in the twilight of his second term and hypersensitive to criticism. On July 14th, Hayes wrote to Grant and denied that he had tried to insult him by renouncing a second term. Putting forth a lame argument, he said he had hoped to harmonize the Republican Party by reassuring younger presidential hopefuls that he wouldn't block their path. When Democrats gathered in St. Louis in late June, they nominated for president Samuel J. Tilden, the New York governor and well-to-do lawyer, after 2 ballots. Having taken on Tammany Hall and the corrupt Tweed Ring, Tilden, like Hayes, laid claim to good government credentials. Imitating Hayes, he also endorsed a one-term limit for presidents. Predictably for a Democratic candidate, he opposed Reconstruction and excoriated the rapacity of carpetbag tyrannies. With all but 3 Southern states now back in the Democratic Party fold, it appeared that a political backlash of monumental proportions had taken hold against Reconstruction. Sensing an abandonment of Reconstruction, Frederick Douglass wondered what good abolition had been for the black man if, having been freed from the slaveholder's lash, he is to be subject to the slaveholder's shotgun. Grant's last year in office was supposed to be a festive season for America, marking the nation's centennial. In 1873, he had announced that an international exhibit, the first such fair in American history, would open in Fairmount Park in Philadelphia in spring 1876. A convinced believer in American progress, Grant had caught the spirit of the age and wished to celebrate American economic gains and the advance of Republican government across the globe. The exposition, he hoped, would showcase our own and foreign skill and progress in manufactures, agriculture, art, science, and civilization. On May 10, 1876, with a crowd of 186,672 on hand, Grant opened the fair, flanked by the Emperor and Empress of Brazil. Following the Centennial Inauguration March, composed by Richard Wagner, and a hymn by John Greenleaf Whittier, the president reviewed a century of development in which forests had been cleared and prairies subdued to make way for advancing settlement. He paid tribute to American industry and fine arts. Most important, he contended the United States now rivaled older and more advanced nations in law, medicine, and theology, in science, literature, philosophy, and the fine arts. So softly did Grant mouth his speech that a frustrated reporter stationed a mere 20 feet away could not catch a single word. Nevertheless, when Grant pronounced the exhibition open, his words set loose a burst of pandemonium. A flag ran up the staff on the main building, the chimes began, the cannon boomed from George's Hill, and the orchestra and chorus pealed forth the majestic Hallelujah Chorus. Grant escorted his Brazilian visitors to Machinery Hall, where they set in motion the huge Corliss engine, the showpiece of the fair. Grant was annoyed that the emperor kept pausing to chat with mechanics, while Julia nursed her own grievances against the empress, who participated in starting up the engine. "I, too, was there on the platform with the president, the emperor, and empress. I, the wife of the president of the United States, I, the wife of General Grant, was there and was not invited to assist at this little ceremony." Julia Grant's pique and acute sense of entitlement show how accustomed she had grown to deference in the White House. The exhibition advertised the technological prowess that had powered American progress and featured every mechanical marvel from Alexander Graham Bell's telephone to Remington's typographic machine. George Washington's dentures and Ben Franklin's hand press were on display. Visitors could also inspect the right arm and torch of the Statue of Liberty before they were whisked off to New York Harbor for assembly into the completed monument. But tributes to America's startling ascent from frontier society to burgeoning industrial power had to contend with Indian troubles brewing on the western plains that belied this triumphant narrative. The problem centered on the Black Hills in present-day South Dakota, where the Oglala Sioux and other tribal bands had been guaranteed a huge reservation under the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie. Serving as a site for many martial and religious rituals, the Black Hills occupied a special niche in the Sioux spiritual world. Despite Grant's pacific intentions, the leading enforcer of his Indian policy was Phil Sheridan, who considered Indian culture barbaric. Sherman's attitude was no less punitive. "Sooner or later, these Sioux have to be wiped out," he observed, "or made to stay just where they are put." In 1874, reacting to rumors of abundant gold seeded in the Black Hills, Sheridan sent George Armstrong Custer and his 7th Cavalry to hunt it out. Custer led a column of 1,000 men armed with cannon and Gatling guns to verify that gold existed. Predictions that the vein embedded there rivaled California's triggered a mad scramble of miners who wished to exploit it. Although Grant took steps to intercept the sudden onslaught of money-mad settlers, pleading with them to stay away, some commanders grew lackadaisical and allowed the prospectors to encroach on sacred Sioux turf. The magnetic tug of instant riches was irresistible in a country still mired in depression. Even as this standoff simmered, Grant traveled to Indian Territory in October, becoming the first president to do so, and praising efforts by 4 tribes to cultivate ranching and lead a more settled life. Though wanting to enforce the Treaty of Fort Laramie and safeguard the Sioux, he recognized that the army couldn't hold back rapacious miners. To resolve the impasse, he offered the Sioux $6 million if they ceded the Black Hills to the federal government. There lay some practical wisdom behind Grant's offer, but one can easily imagine the chief's horror at auctioning off their sacred lands. In early 1875, Grant sent an expert geologist to the region to validate that it contained gold. If it were found in large quantities, Secretary of the Interior Delano informed Grant, his department would protect the rights of the Indians as guaranteed to them by the Treaty of 1868. But he also intended to use every effort possible to extinguish the Indian title to the Black Hills country and open the same to settlement and explorations for mineral wealth at the earliest day practicable. Thus, the Grant administration pursued two contradictory missions: to protect Sioux treaty rights and to pave the way for the inexorable invasion of predatory miners. In case the Sioux didn't get the message, Sheridan prepared to establish a military post in the Black Hills, perched on the western edge of their reservation. On May 26, 1875, Grant met Sioux leaders at the White House and entreated them to relocate farther south, where he claimed the climate was better, the grass richer, the buffalo more abundant. He explained the extreme difficulty of interdicting white settlers, predicting the problem would only intensify and spur violent clashes. Under the Sioux Treaty, the federal government had promised supplies, but, Grant warned, in the event of fighting, he would be forced to withhold them. "My interest is in seeing you protected," he continued, "while I have the power to make treaties with you which shall protect you. But the Sioux must settle the question of the limits of your hunting grounds and make preliminary arrangements to allow white persons to go into the Black Hills. Federal payments for the Black Hills would take the form of government bonds, with semi-annual interest applied to benefit the Sioux." Despite Grant's evident concern for their welfare, he was offering them a suicide pact for their culture, urging that he wanted to see their children attending schools, and future generations speaking English and preparing themselves for the life of white men. While Grant dealt with the nascent Sioux crisis, he received an explosive letter from Professor Othniel Marsh of Yale College, outlining pervasive corruption at the Red Cloud Agency that furnished Sioux supplies in northwest Nebraska near the Black Hills. Marsh laid out a lurid tale of putrid pork, inferior flour, rotten tobacco, and other shoddy goods foisted upon the tribe. He stated categorically that the Interior Secretary and Commissioner of Indian Affairs worked not to correct fraud, but to suppress knowledge of it. Marsh directly challenged Grant. "You alone have the will and the power to destroy that combination of bad men known as the Indian Ring, who are debasing this service and thwarting the efforts of all who endeavor to bring to a full consummation your noble policy of peace." Grant assured Marsh of his earnest desire for an honest administration in every department of the government and willingness to ferret out and punish fraud wherever found. That same day, he told Secretary of the Interior Delano that the agent at the Red Cloud Agency was wholly incompetent and easily led without his knowledge to work the designs of bad and unscrupulous men. Not standing on ceremony, Grant also directed Delano's attention to serious accusations against him. Perhaps stung by criticism of the ethical shortcomings of his administration, Grant convened a commission to travel to Nebraska to study the Red Cloud Agency, one that included waspish critics of Delano. Clearly, Grant meant business. Remarkably, he met with Marsh, a gadfly who had publicly chastised Indian policy, three times, giving him a warm reception in contrast to his frigid treatment at Interior. Grant accepted Delano's resignation, replacing him with the former Michigan Senator Zachariah Chandler, a bluff, amiable man, and a robust fundraiser for the Republican Party. Since he had criticized civil service reform, his selection disappointed journalists seeking a purge of the scandal-ridden Interior Department. When the commissioners arrived in Nebraska to confer with Sioux chiefs, their spokesman proceeded to tell them that Grant, the great father in Washington, had sent them to uncover wrongdoing. If the agent or any of the contractors who have been employed by our government to furnish you goods and supplies have cheated you, we want to find that out. Red Cloud responded that he didn't want Army officers acting as Indian agents. Then he turned to the momentous issue that overshadowed corruption. Facing the Black Hills, he said, "The people from the states who have gone to the Black Hills are stealing gold, digging it out and taking it away, and I don't see why the Great Father don't bring them back." In early November, a pastoral delegation met with Grant and expressed concern that he had renounced his Indian peace policy. "Far from it," Grant insisted. He hoped it would become so firmly established as to be the necessary policy of his successors. After meeting with another critic, George H. Stewart, who had resigned from the Board of Indian Commissioners, Grant received a congratulatory letter from him, applauding how he had banished crooked Indian agents and installed vastly superior men who were as faithful and honest as any class of men in the government service. Stewart foresaw a vindication of Grant's Indian policy. "The policy is doing what was never before really attempted. It is teaching the Indians civilization and Christianity, giving them books, schools, homes, and churches, and the result will be in a few years the settlement of the Indian question, and they will be, as the colored people now largely are, able to take care of themselves." Such euphoria would prove woefully short-sighted. On November 3, 1875, Grant presided over a confidential White House meeting that soon left his peace policy in ruins. At a parley with Sheridan, Belknap, Chandler, and Brigadier General George Crook, Grant concluded they could no longer resist the wave of miners washing over the Black Hills. While he didn't rescind the order keeping them from the area, he indicated it should no longer be rigidly enforced, since opposing the miners only increased their desire and complicated the troubles. Relaxing the order would open the floodgates of settlement and menace the Sioux. Still more threatening to them was the decision to force Sitting Bull, a brave warrior and holy man with an almost mystical following, who had opposed the sale of the Black Hills, and his band of Sioux outside the reservation, to relocate on agency land by the tight deadline of January 31, 1876. If they failed to do so, Grant would send a military force to ensure their compliance. When Sitting Bull flouted this unrealistic timetable, Chandler told Belknap that the Indians in question had been turned over to his War Department. After Belknap notified Sheridan to take action, Brigadier General Alfred H. Terry formed three columns to march against Sitting Bull and his quietly charismatic ally, Crazy Horse. Part of that force was to include George Armstrong Custer, a West Point graduate who had stood out during the Civil War as an intrepid cavalry officer. Feared by his men, Custer was also admired for his flair and flamboyant audacity. He struck colorful poses in combat, his fringed buckskin suits and blonde hair flowing in the breeze as he led charges. His ferocity won Phil Sheridan's admiration, although Grant took a much more nuanced view, praising his personal gallantry and valor, while condemning him as not a very level-headed man. Custer, vain, headstrong, narcissistic, was the very antithesis of Grant. A Democrat who had idolized George McClellan, he had often been insubordinate, intrigued against superiors, lobbied for his personal advancement, and gambled and womanized. He had also supported Andrew Johnson, opposed Grant for president, and worked against Reconstruction. So it came as no surprise that when Grant lauded Custer, he quoted Sheridan's opinion, not his own. As he wrote in 1866, there was no cavalry officer in whom Sheridan lodged greater confidence, and no officer in whose judgment I have greater faith than in Sheridan's. Not long after the war, Grant received reports of Custer's cruelty toward his men. One charging that Custer habitually inflicted the most brutal and unusual punishments for trifling offenses. In 1867, Custer underwent a court-martial for ordering deserters to be shot, and Grant seemed to consider him guilty. The following year, Custer and his cavalry obliterated an Indian village on the Washita River, wantonly murdering more than 100 Southern Cheyenne, including women and children. In late March 1876, Custer testified before Representative Heister Clymer's Committee on War Department Expenditures and accused Belknap of corruption. Recklessly self-promoting, he insinuated that Grant had tampered with the Sioux Reservation boundary to assist the corrupt practices of Belknap and Delano. Angered by these groundless accusations, Grant instructed Sherman and Sheridan that he didn't want Custer to supervise one of the columns in the impending campaign against Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. Eager to be part of the expedition, Custer worked to rally public opinion in his favor. Tamping down his pride, he went to the White House on May 1st to seek an interview with Grant and cooled his heels for 5 hours. According to one press account, Custer sat in the waiting room unsent for until the president's calling hour was over, although he repeatedly sent in his card. When Grant at last sent out a message that he couldn't see him, Custer stormed out in disgust. "Custer is trying to browbeat the president," Belknap wrote. "He may succeed." Press reports intimated that Sherman had pleaded with Grant that Custer was the best man to lead the Sioux campaign, but Grant replied that Custer had tried to besmirch his administration, and he proposed to put a stop to it. Custer feared he would lose face with his regiment if he were sidelined during the Sioux campaign, and he begged Grant to spare him the humiliation of seeing my regiment march to meet the enemy and I not to share its dangers. Phil Sheridan took his side. In the end, Grant wouldn't overrule Sheridan, and on May 8th decided to allow Custer to join the expedition, leading his regiment in Brigadier General Alfred Terry's column. "Advise Custer to be prudent, not to take along any newspaper men who always work mischief, and to abstain from any personalities in the future," Sherman told Terry. The Sioux had acquired the reputation, Sherman said, of being the most brave and warlike savages of this continent. By late May, Phil Sheridan confessed that his two department commanders, Generals Crook and Terry, hadn't the foggiest idea where Sitting Bull and his Sioux warriors had fled. Sheridan took refuge in the illusion that a large body of hostile Indians couldn't remain cohesive for long, and even imagined that the approach of three columns would herd them back onto the reservation. Shattering such naive expectations, on June 17th, Crazy Horse led a band of warriors against the 1,000-man column under General Crook, dealing them a bloody setback and driving them rearward to their base camp. As Custer drifted westward toward his doom, he knew nothing of this stunning defeat. As the nation got ready to solemnize its centennial on July 4th, reports filtered back that Custer and 263 of his men in the 7th Cavalry had been annihilated by Lakota Sioux and Northern Cheyenne warriors along the Little Bighorn River in southern Montana, their mutilated bodies strewn among the hills. Custer was found naked, a bullet hole in his head, a gash in his thigh, an arrow piercing his penis. Supposed to be marching toward a rendezvous with Generals Terry and John Gibbon, he had arrived too soon, failed to wait for other troops, and confronted alone an enormous Indian force favored with overpowering numbers. "I deeply deplore the loss of Custer and his men," Sheridan wrote. "I feel it was an unnecessary sacrifice due to misapprehension and a superabundance of courage, the latter extraordinarily developed in Custer." People could scarcely fathom the shocking news, and Custer soon acquired an aura of martyrdom. Some speculated that, unhinged by his feud with Grant, he had acted rashly to show his bravery. Grant refused to accept that. In a newspaper interview, he placed blame for the disaster squarely on Custer's shoulders. "I regard Custer's massacre as a sacrifice of troops brought on by Custer himself that was wholly unnecessary. He was not to have made the attack before effecting the junction with Terry and Gibbon. He was notified to meet them on the 26th, but instead of marching slowly, as his orders required in order to effect the junction on the 26th, he enters upon a forced march of 83 miles in 24 hours, and thus has to meet the Indians alone on the 25th. General Crook is the best, wiliest Indian fighter in this country. He has had vast experience in Indian fighting. He is as wily as Sitting Bull in this respect, that when he finds himself outnumbered and taken at a disadvantage, he prudently retreats. In Custer's case, Sitting Bull had 10 men to every one of Custer." Whoever was to blame for the Little Bighorn calamity, the national response was a ferocious outcry for Indian blood bordering on the genocidal. E. L. Godkin of The Nation, who had embraced Grant's peace policy, reflected the altered sentiment. "Our philanthropy and our hostility tend to about the same end, and this is the destruction of the Indian race." By July 8th, as he consulted at the White House with his military advisors, Grant rushed to shore up forces in the West while outraged Americans volunteered for service. "We must not have another massacre like Custer's, and Congress is now in session willing to give us all we want," Sherman advised Sheridan. On August 11th, Grant asked Congress to expand the cavalry by 2,500 men and requested authority to call up 5 more regiments to deal with the emergency created by the massacre. In the wake of the disaster, Grant was less reticent in talking about the gold found in the Black Hills. That August, former Governor Newton Edmunds of Dakota Territory brought gold samples to the White House. "When the mines shall have been thoroughly explored," Grant predicted, "as much gold will be found there as in California." Such remarks guaranteed a stampede of prospectors to the area. At the same time, Grant recommended that people stay away until the present troubles are over and until we have extinguished the titles of the Indians to the lands which they sold by treaty. That December, the federal government took legal possession of the Black Hills. There was something profoundly contradictory about Grant's attitude toward the whole situation. In addressing Congress in December, he placed ultimate blame for what had happened to the Sioux on the white men. "Hostilities there have grown out of the avarice of the white man, who has violated our treaty stipulation in his search for gold." All along, he had ardently desired to bring justice to Native Americans. This raised questions of why Grant had caved in to greedy miners. To answer this, he invoked force majeure, saying that rumors of rich discoveries of gold had drawn miners to the region, and any effort to remove them would have led to desertion by the bulk of troops sent there. In other words, U.S. troops would have refused to thwart the miners, even under direct orders from the president. Thus, Ulysses S. Grant, an advocate of a peace policy toward the Indians, found himself willy-nilly on the side of those raping their lands and violating a sacred treaty commitment. In the last analysis, Grant had to favor the American electorate and sacrifice the Sioux. It was a terribly ironic coda to a policy premised upon humane treatment of Native Americans. The outcome was fine as far as Phil Sheridan was concerned. "This was the country of the buffalo and the hostile Sioux only last year," he wrote in 1877. "There are no signs of either now, but in their places we found prospectors, emigrants, and farmers." Quite a different verdict was rendered by the U.S. Court of Claims in 1979. Reviewing the federal government's dealings with the Sioux, the court said of the Black Hills episode that "a more ripe and rank case of dishonorable dealing will never, in all probability, be found in our history." Lost amid recriminations over Little Bighorn, was that on June 9th, Grant had made amends to another oppressed group, attending the dedication of Adas Israel Synagogue in Washington, home to an Orthodox Jewish congregation. It was the first time an American president ever attended a synagogue consecration, and yet another instance of Grant atoning for General Orders No. 11, his infamous wartime edict. A synagogue dedication was a small-time affair, yet Grant brought a distinguished retinue to the neat brick building, including his son Buck, Senator Thomas Ferry of Michigan, the Methodist minister John P. Newman, and the lawyer Simon Wolfe, all of whom were seated on sofas near the podium. Because Vice President Henry Wilson had died on November 22, 1875, Ferry, who was president pro tempore of the Senate, would succeed Grant if he did not finish his term. The American flag was draped on both sides of the Torah Ark, and the narrow, gaslit room was fragrant with bouquets. Officiating was the Philadelphia rabbi George Jacobs, clad in black robe and cap. Since the prayers were in Hebrew, Grant sat through long portions chanted in a foreign tongue. With political tact, Jacobs offered a prayer to the President of the United States, along with senators and representatives. He and the scroll-bearers then circled seven times around the sanctuary, as prescribed by ancient ritual. Jacobs delivered a sermon in English about the patriarch Jacob, who beheld in a dream a mystical ladder upon which angels went up and down. For three straight hours, Grant sat in the modest room, his hat on in homage to Jewish custom, as humble as a penitent in sackcloth. In a mark of respect, he never spoke. Congregation elders made clear that he need not feel obliged to sit through the entire ceremony, but he made a point of staying to the end. At the close, when he made a $10 donation, the congregation extended heartfelt thanks for his unusual presence and generous gift. Grant's attendance at the dedication crowned the special solicitude he had shown for the Jewish community throughout his presidency. As Simon Wolfe wrote during Woodrow Wilson's tenure, "President Grant did more on behalf of American citizens of Jewish faith at home and abroad than all the presidents of the United States prior thereto or since."